Your signal.
Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are fighting unethical persuasion wherever it rears its ugly mouth, and it's everywhere. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, escaped professor, also stand-up comedian and late-night comedy writer. For jokes, follow us over at Twitter at Rhetoric War. I joke all day long. That's a good use of Twitter, I think. Much better than Trump. I think jokes.
He jokes lost over his, irritation. He lost it.
Yeah.
He's gone.
So here's a few jokes from the week. Something I noticed watching sports this weekend. Insurance companies need to hire better comedy writers. Like they like the comedy, but I don't think they quite understand the demands of the form.
You're not in favor of the emu, whatever that campaign was.
It's they all have it, right? I mean, I guess
yeah.
Geico, like they've all jumped on the comedy bandwagon. I mean, hire just anybody. It's bad. Also, I'm a big fan of her work, but I think Gladys Knight's first version, Midnight Train to New Hampshire, just didn't really work. And last thing.
You're working it out.
You got to try everywhere. They should do one a version for every state.
Every state, yeah. It's like Monopoly. You can get Monopoly based in your, you know, in Wichita now.
You should do, 50 re-releases, you know, and then move around the rest of the world too.
It's like Cameo. It's like, hey, pay me, I'll say your state.
Georgia really is the only state, I think, that works, you know, as a dramatic element of a song. Like there's, you know, Georgia Mine, there's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you get a feel for it. The only way I actually have a feel for Georgia is through, you know, the songs.
Yeah, it's a rainy night in Georgia.
Yeah, yeah.
Georgia works.
Yeah.
Something about it. And then I live here in Austin, and there's a lot of polyamory here. A lot of throuples and group relationships.
Yeah.
And so I wrote some love songs for the polyamorous. There's... Three Tickets to Paradise, great Eddie Money song. I Will Always Love Y'all, Whitney Houston. Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman and a Man and Another Woman. And finally, the great George Jones with He Stopped Loving Them Today.
Don't forget Tammy Wynette, Stand By Your Men.
Oh, there you go. See, insurance companies, you have a comedy writer.
That's right. Give me that emu. I'll make that emu funny.
We'll make that emu funny. So this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are converting conservatives, talking to comedians about their politics, and getting great persuasion ideas from persuasion pros. Go to rhetoricwarriors.com, sign up for a course. We have a new course. Just launched it last week, Converting Conservatives, Changing the World by Altering One Conservative at a Time. That's my favorite course right now. There's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah. It's not lucrative because it's only one at a time, but, you know.
Well, my thing is
you're in it for the long haul.
Like 80 million people voted for Biden. If everybody just picked one conservative instead of arguing on social media, just pick, you know, your uncle or your dad or whoever, you know, and just focus on them for the next 2 years. If you got 20% conversion, you'd never lose another election.
Yeah, yeah.
So that course teaches you how to do it. It's quite a process, conversion.
Yeah, I know. I like it.
So my guest today is his second trip around the Rhetoric Warrior podcast sun. He's a great showrunner, comedy showrunner, comedian. Good dude all around. Welcome back, Eddie Feldman.
Already been comp. Nice to see you, Dan.
And
it's sunny. I see that sliver of light behind you there.
I know. I've got it's just pouring in.
You have
right
your key light. Over. Yeah. I had to, looks good.
The production level podcast, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So last time, Eddie, we talked about you know, some comedy stuff and throwing together. How you throw together TV shows and you know, the work behind that, because that's a type of message construction that most people never get to see. But you have a really interesting work history, just in general. But a couple of the silos in there, you know, I think they just make people's head whip around.
Yeah, I like that. Actually, I don't say, yeah, it's like, hey, I'll give this a try. Why not? Yeah, I don't really want to be that, like, oh, you know what? He's done the same thing for 40 years. It's like, yeah, you know, no, I like to reinvent myself continually, if possible.
So tell us some of the shows that you've done beyond the one that we're going to talk about today. Like just give people a little retrospective of the Eddie career.
Okay. So starting in, you know, started out in stand-up. Actually, before that, started out working with delinquent kids because I have a degree in criminal justice. Segued from that, I got myself laid off and collecting unemployment so that I could start doing some open mic nights.
You were a showrunner. That's
yeah. Early on. Yeah. It's like, well, I got to finance this. So
yeah, because you're not going to get anybody from comedy. Laid off.
Yeah. No. Not at the beginning. So yeah, did a lot of stand up and that sort of thing. On the journey, some weird sort of stuff. I was a warm-up comedian for a show, Scruples, that was a pilot, which was based on the game Scruples. And it was hosted by somebody, this guy I don't know, and I think Rita Moreno. And I introduced Rita Moreno and she came out and she bent down and I thought she was like to give her like a little kiss on the cheek, and I kissed her on the cheek. She goes, no, I was going to talk in the microphone. I'm like, oh, I just sexually assaulted Rita Moreno. But so, you know, throughout that course, yeah, then, but some of the other.
You updated for 3 years. Yeah.
What's that? Yeah.
You updated for 3 years.
Yeah. 20 years older than me, but why not?
No.
She's a star. I mean, it's been done. It's in Hollywood. It's one of those things of like, well, it's just that, you know, only 20 years. So,
yeah.
So some of the other shows that might be, you know, then I've written for Law and Order, which is not comedy.
What? When did you do that?
Oh, yeah. Even that.
I didn't know that.
I did, while I was doing Dennis Miller's show, I was off, you know, for 3 months at a time, the HBO show. And I was a huge fan of Law and Order, watched it every night. Loved it. It was close to what my degree was in criminology. And then at a Writers Guild kind of little soiree, it turns out I ran into the two executive producers from Law & Order and told them, I go, hey, I love your show, but my wife hates it because I'm watching it all the time. And I mentioned, I go, hey, if I had an idea for a show, could I come pitch it to you? And they're like, oh yeah, why not? So I pitched them this idea for one of an episode. They're like, oh, we really like it. Why don't you write it? I'm like, okay.
All right.
So then they end up writing it. It got produced. And then for like 4 years, every break I had from the HBO show, I'd write an episode of Law and Order. And so I either would come up for an idea or they would give me one that they wanted me to write. But, you know, so I kind of got my drama chops.
Awesome. I love that.
Winning that's, drama.
That's yeah. That's great, man. Law and Order. What a franchise that thing is. I mean, I think they're going to run out of crime at some point. Like how much crime is there?
There is. I mean, I remember when Law and Order, the, you know, SUV, as you say, SVU, whatever you want to call it. And then even one of the guys that I knew from Law & Order goes, yeah, but how long can that run, really? And it's been on longer than the original one.
Yeah.
You know, so I never wrote for that one, but that's a great show. Yeah, they did. They found a great, you know, formula and template. The Law & Orders were fun to write. You know, there's a strategy to it. There's a technique because you have to write for the back, you know, the back half, it starts at the end, really, and right. Then you kind of work forward, and there's got to be certain twists. So, yeah, that fell really into my criminal justice background, and was, you know, ended up writing some other crime shows, and still writing some of my own now.
That's awesome. I always thought with Sam Waterston, you know, what a great actor, but how many times can you play moral outrage?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah, they're apparently for many years.
Yeah, like he just seems constantly
as long as you get that check.
Just disappointed in humanity.
Yeah, just that look of like, yeah. Well, having worked in the actual part of the criminal justice system, it's like, yeah, it just happens in real life all the time. You're just always shocked by like, okay, what did this kid do now? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, any human being can access their disappointment in other human beings, right? As an emotional right?
Yeah. Well, there was one kid that I was on my caseload, you know, really, I think it was like 18 or so. And this was in Northampton, Massachusetts. And so I got a call because a detective had picked him up and they thought that maybe he had stolen something or that. So I had to go in and sit there with the detective and this guy. And so we're talking, and then, you know, the detective is trying to draw stuff out of the kid. And then finally he just kind of gives up and's like, oh, okay, man, I'll tell you what happened, who I am, what happened and that. And he goes, yeah, I want to admit to something that, and the detective's like, what? And he's looking at me like, what's this? What's coming up? He goes, yeah, I'm the sorry burglar. And the detective looked and it's like, the sorry burglar. And then I realized in the newspaper about a month before, what happened is somebody burglarized a house. And then a few weeks later, took the stuff back and put it on the porch and wrote a note saying, I broke in, I took this stuff, I shouldn't have, and signed it to sorry burglar. And it was like this big story. It was in the local Northampton paper. And so the cop is like, wait, I know you're the sorry burglar? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, so the cop goes to him, the detective said, well, yeah, you know, let me ask you something. And he says, you know, so what happened? He goes, well, so I went and broke into the house and I'm, you know, getting stuff and I'm putting in a box. And I went in the closet and there was like a mink stole. And so I didn't know what, I couldn't carry it. I put on the mink stole. It was like a white mink and I'm walking around. And all of a sudden I saw my reflection in the mirror. And this kid was African-American. He's looked at, and I'm like, oh, this is ridiculous, man. And then so afterwards I felt bad about it. And then I returned the stuff. He goes, well, you know, everything was returned, but there was like $400 in silver dollars that never got back. And the kid looks at him and goes, hey, I'm sorry, I'm not stupid. And then I'm like, we're all laughing. I'm like, what? I'm laughing at my kid. Yeah, he stole. It's like, what's a good line though?
Yeah. Was that a Law and Order episode? Did you write that up?
No, I think I wrote it into some other stuff or other things and in the pilots and that, but I don't think I ever got it into the in there. Although, you know, I should have.
Yeah, a kid even, you know, buttoned it. He even threw a button at the end with a, you know, solid punch.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like, and we're laughing. All right, let's go to jail. So.
That kid needs to write. He needs to be a Law and Order writer.
Oh yeah, he was funny, smart, you know.
Interesting.
That's just.
Well, I don't know. We could just talk about Law and Order. We could talk about crime the whole time. We've already got 20 minutes in. But let's veer over. We'll come back to something else at some other point. But let's veer over to the job that I think is a head whipper for you, like especially coming from comedy writing, although I didn't know you did drama. You had some drama background too. So you kind of had a range.
Yeah, that's the whole point of whiplash, is to go forward and then backwards into the... as quickly as possible.
All right. Yeah, so you got range.
In my job at show running and stuff, I would get a call at different times from this headhunting company that mostly dealt with like TV executives. And they'd be like, hey, you know, we're looking for someone to run TV at Fox, like looking for a late night person and that. And I would give them some recommendations, say, oh, so-and-so over at Comedy Central is really talented. Maybe you want to contact him. So, well, same thing happened. I get a call and they're like, hey, we're looking for a head writer for this company. I'm like, well, what's the company? And they're like, well, it's the WWE, you know, wrestling. And I'm like, oh, okay. I go, well, let me think about who I might know that might be good for it. And I was kind of as a kid, every guy is like a big wrestling fan.
Sure, yeah.
You know, we watched it, and then you get older, and then you have a girlfriend, and they go, hey, we're not watching that. And then your wrestling watching is over.
They stomp on
it. Yeah, they're like, well, yeah, we're not, you know, like, no, I don't know. So anyway, then they said, well, what about you? Would you, you know, be interested in talking about it? I'm like, yeah, sure. Like I said, I never say no, because maybe I'll find something and I'll write about that experience. So I talk to them about it. I don't know if that's for me, you know. And then they called me back a few weeks later and said, well, we have another job for it. Would you want to talk about that? And it was like the SVP of creative. It was a little higher. It was closer to like being an executive producer really than a head writer. And so I started this process. I talked to like Stephanie McMahon, Vince McMahon's daughter, like on a Zoom call or whatever it was, Skype. And then they were like, well, yeah, she really likes you. You know, would you fly out to Stanford to meet Vince McMahon? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, it was funny because I was like, I remember as a kid, because his family kind of had in the Hudson Valley, that's kind of where they were starting, like Albany, that was their federations, New York. And so we used to make always like McMahon and like, and with my friends and Tina, you know, about his father. And so, So I flew out, I met with him, which was, you know, kind of bizarre because it's this, it's like, he's not only runs the company, he's a, you know, a star of that. And get back. And then, so lo and behold, I end up, they're like, hey, you know, let's want to try this for like 3 months. And I'm like, yeah, why not? So I'm like, yeah. So I basically picked up and for 3 months, they put me in a, you know, a corporate apartment and went there. And then so started working for wrestling, already doing the WWE creatively. And then it worked out and I stayed for, you know, like another year. And so, yeah, it was in some ways though. Yeah. In some ways. And I told Vince, I go, oddly enough, if you took all the things I ever did in my life, you know, and put them in a computer and they spit something out, I have an idea that would spit out wrestling because there's a lot of similarities, to stand up, to writing, to law and order, to drama and all that storytelling and being a stand up myself. That would lend itself to what they do.
So like, what do you, when you say that, like with the stand up, like what is there, what are the things that you learned in stand up that applied in WWE?
Well, you know, so every wrestler is what they call them, an independent contractor, but every comedian has a point of view and every wrestler has a point of view. And that's how they, that's their character. That's who they speak. Sometimes it's closer to who they really are or not, but you know, they stand there in the middle of a ring and cut a promo, which is really talking into a microphone and entertaining people in a very sort of, in a very entertaining way. Well, that's what stand-up is, a microphone and you're talking to the audience and you're kind of winning them over on your side. So that part of it was that working for people, you know, like comedians, it's like, okay. And putting them in situations and writing and, you know, scripted stuff, that part of it, the promotional day-to-day running a writer's room for, or dealing with wrestling writers, it's all written. So that part was similar. Doing things like promotional stuff, like, hey, we have to, you know, instead of shooting a promotional spot for one of the late night shows, it's more creating a you know, advertiser-based spot for wrestling. So Subway is like, Subway wants to do something entertaining for like, you know, a minute, and so like, hey, you have to write that, produce that, get that together. So that part of it was, you know, it's like, oh, I know how to do those things. The actual, and as far as the wrestling goes, nobody knows wrestling better than Vince McMahon or all the other wrestlers that work there. So I can't, you know, it was more like, oh, I'm gonna learn that part of it, but they need help in more of the TV part of it that they don't do.
So you didn't write like wrestling scripts, right? I mean, they work all that stuff out. Like, did you make suggestions for moves in the ring?
No, not the moves. But so the way that that's broken down is still that way somewhat now, is that there's a writing staff. There was like 30 writers. And then who basically come up with the matches, the ideas. It starts with WrestleMania and works backwards. So just like Law and Order, it's like, okay, at the end of our year, you know, we wanted to have this type of show. And now we start to build it throughout the year. It's like a reality show. It's like it's storytelling. Vince would always say, you know, a match is just a match. Tell me the story that leads me there. Otherwise I really don't give a shit. I'm, you know, what it is. So that's what the writers have to do, is kind of sometimes creating characters, sometimes creating storylines, and also in, unlike, you know, drama, well, oh, hey, I have a great storyline. Oh, but the wrestler got injured. He can't wrestle. Now what? Now I got to change it. Now you have to sort of change it up. So every week you're creating, you know, the writers, who some were stand, some were comedy writers. Some came, a lot of them are soap opera writers.
Really?
Because you're kind of telling those stories. Yeah, that's where they kind of drew from. Some were huge wrestling fans as kids. Some kind of learned it as they went along. And so you're basically creating these stories that as you go. And the idea is, you know, what's going to pull in? They're basically like good and bad, heel. Mm-hmm. And baby face. And it's like, there's always like two sides of the ledger. There's the good people and the bad people, you know, and you're creating these stories based on the good people. And sometimes there's like, if there's a tag team, you realize like eventually, even though it's like Cain and Abel, eventually they're not going to get along. Oh, right. And then one guy and then that one guy becomes a good guy. One guy's okay. That's another storyline that you sort of, take. And then so really you create stories really a lot like in a way like dramas or sitcoms out of your life, out of stuff that people can relate to. And so that's what I found, you know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I
that's exactly the same job, right?
Yeah. And then at that time it was funny because very much like somebody we know is president, they, you know, in wrestling, they would get, you know, get rid of people like, you're fired, I'm firing you. And they had that a lot. And it's like, and I think Vince was like, oh, we're always firing people. And isn't there something else? You know, what do we do? And then I remember that Dennis Miller telling me that, you know, when he was at Saturday Night Live, he said the way that Lorne Michaels, you know, kept everybody kind of in check was that if you started to get too famous, he would hire somebody who kind of looked like you. He said, you know, when Carvey was getting big and all that, all of a sudden he hires David Spade. It's like, oh, there's another blonde guy in that world. So I remember saying to them, explaining to the writers that and said, so maybe there's a way that a storyline that that's what that you can do. And because Dusty Rhodes was a big famous wrestler for years and he had two sons, I'm like, well, maybe there's something there where you have, you bring Goldust back and Cody and, you know, you have them as two brothers and, you know, and then the head, you know, the McMahon family is like, you know, okay, well, if whoever loses is going to, you know, is going to have to leave. It's a, you know, match. So whoever loses leaves. So that seemed to work. And then we had this idea that was, it's like, okay, so they need something else, bigger stakes. Well, Dusty Rhodes at that time was working, developing wrestlers for the WWE. So kind of came up with this idea was now they become a tag team. And then what happens is they have a big match. If they lose the match, Dusty Rhodes has to leave the WWE.
I remember that storyline. Yeah.
And it's funny because that became, which I didn't know, it came pretty popular because lo and behold, I ran into Dennis Miller's son, Holden, who's like a huge wrestling fan. And we were talking and I mentioned that. He goes, oh, that was like my favorite thing. And I'm like, really? I go, yeah. But I go, well, it came because your father told me that, you know, this is what Lorne Michaels would do. And Lorne is kind of the overlord, kind of like just like the McMahon family. So, yeah, I mean, it's those storylines when you think about what wrestling, how it started before TV is you would walk into Madison Square Garden and there'd be two people there and you're like, well, who am I rooting for? And like, oh, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? And it made it very easy, you know, depending on what they look like or who they or what they how they spoke in the microphone. You're like, oh, I hate that guy. That's the whole thing.
Right.
Of building up the hate for it.
Well, that is, I mean, that is Trumpian politics. That's it exactly, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even though you root for the bad guy. I mean, I don't know if I think I told you this story, but I found out too, like Muhammad Ali, when he was Cassius Clay, went to see professional wrestling in Buffalo. And so when he got there, Gorgeous George was this big heel at the time. And Gorgeous George basically was, I'm so pretty, you right. can't beat me. And Cash just, and Ali goes, you know what? I bet there's more money in being that guy than being the guy who wins. It's like, and me as a black guy, I'm gonna make every white guy pay their hard-earned money to see me get beat, but I'm not gonna get beat. And they're gonna pay it again and again. And that's kind of like how you tell your wrestling story. It's like, oh, they almost beat him. Well, maybe next time. It's like, oh, but to pay again.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that, watching Muhammad Ali talk about that on multiple talk shows. And given, you know, literally saying, I saw that, and I'm like, hey, that's a good gig. I'm going to type that and use it for myself, and, you know, turn it into this massive storyline that just took over the world.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But that came out, you know, just came out of,
out of wrestling,
professional wrestling
gave us Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. And took the money out of your father's pocket. Yeah, I mean, it's like rope-a-dope. What's that? It's like, hey, it's just another way that I can, you know, have another match. That wasn't set. I mean, that's what happens in wrestling all the time. It's like, oh, wait a minute, he escaped. Oh, we'll have to come back next week and see what happens.
Yeah, and it uses really, you know, old and hardcore narrative techniques, you know, that people, again, if you're not professional at storytelling and this kind of writing and construction, you don't really think in those terms, that there's all sorts of things for you to harvest from that have already been created as templates and as ideas, and just the good versus evil, you know, the whole, that kind of stuff. You know, one of the arguments I make about rhetorically what happened with Trump was the, you know, one of the things that he imported was, you know, storytelling, that kind of entertainment level storytelling. And nobody else was doing that. In politics. Politics doesn't run on those same kind of storylines. So he started new storylines and they just broke politics.
Yeah, when he talks about drain the swamp, you know, that's the classic wrestling thing. It's like, he didn't have an idea like, oh, I need to get these people out. It's like, he just floated out there, drain. And then people were like, yeah, drain the swamp. Like, all right, okay, now we got to come up with policy it's all slogan based. It's like,
yeah.
You know, it's like rock. Kind
of think tanks and PR firms, you know, on the right, they're very good about using professional communication resources to what you did, which is to hand things down for the performers to use, preformed, great script, explosive when people see it. And it just, it just erupts in ways that normal politics doesn't.
Well, I mean, you know, if you think same, that's the you know, comedy. It's like, you know, I'm white, you can't fix stupid. It's like, I get that. You know, you don't have to tell me the joke. You're like, can't fix stupid. Okay. Well, I can, you know, now I'm going to give you examples of that, but I already know where you're going, you know, get her done.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff, it's, you know, when it's done right, when it's a really crisp line that captures something and it's right in that guy's voice and he can deliver it, or, you know, it's just magic, right? It raises up to a level that ordinary talk, you know, and even, you know, the traditional political talk isn't even close. It just blows it away.
Yeah. I mean, that's why when, you know, those debates with the Republicans, 18 Republicans, they didn't know what to do. They just looked at it like, well, we you know, even the debates with, you know, with Biden, a couple, you know, of that, that actually Biden, I always felt, did better in the first debate because he basically said, hey, a guy's lying. It's like, oh, idiot. Just a clown. It's like, yeah, that's the way to debate something like that. It was the second one that they did where I didn't think he did as well because he was trying to get his, you know, get his policy out.
Yeah.
But I think he could have, you know, the third one would have, for me, would have been, I get my policy out and you're a clown. There's no, you know, I'm doing this, but you're still an idiot. You know?
Yeah. That policy description, you know, you look at the wonky kind of nature of governing. And the politicians that are governors, they want to tell you their policy, but people can't process that stuff. They don't know what it means. Yeah. And it's like, that's not what public performance of, you know, elections and politics is. And it's going to become more and more and more Trumpian, right?
Like, yeah.
They've got to import, you know, we're talking about insurance companies to import real comedy writers. Well, politicians got to import really real storytellers and real, you know, showrunners for that stuff, right? I mean, there's going to be no other option.
Oh yeah, I think so. I think you'll have to, you know, be able to, you know, tell those, you know, it's like, because what happens to the politic, you realize is they tell that same story over and over. And just like a stand up, hey, once you tell it on national TV, hey, we heard that. It's like, okay, yeah, what's your next one? And you know, Klobuchar would have the same story. And you're like, you heard that, you know what? That's finding your comedy club stump speeches when you go from town to town, but now you're on the Tonight Show or a national stage, and it's like, okay, what's happening? Who, you know? And I think that's probably a good thing for, you know, the current administration of like, and I didn't know, you know, guys that write some stuff, is like, have some fresh stuff, because you're right, Trump, for whatever you're saying about his policy, which were none, there is no policy. It was just, hey, I'm good at spinning yarns and look at this and making up names and sleepy this. Yeah. Hey, what about that?
It's blowing like, things up. That's what the guy does.
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, no, it's like, I never do anything. It's like, I'm a Yelp reviewer. Just, you know, I don't open the restaurant or do anything. I just go there and it's like, well, this food is like this. It's like, yeah, it's entertaining. It's like, doesn't get me fed.
Yeah, it's something that's going to have to be reckoned with, and you know, the design of politics, because it hasn't been, and it's too powerful. And I think one of the fascinating things talking to you about like this kind of a job, like you said, you had a bunch of training from other areas of your, you know, career and stuff, but you imported all that over and kind of reinfused wrestling, probably with some different approaches that they hadn't really experienced before, I would imagine, you know, coming from comedy, ideas.
Yeah. And again, their thing is not so much, they don't want, you know, Vince is always like, we don't do comedy.
Right.
What they do. And actually I did that somewhat in Law and Order, is they create characters that are that can be amusing. You know, they don't say jokes necessarily, maybe a little bit, but mostly it's like, okay, there's an over the top sort of character. You know, just like if you're writing it for a drama or one of those things, you know, and one of my Law and Orders, I would always have, because it was kind of before The Sopranos, my mob characters, I had one of those episodes where we're kind of like, yeah, over the top big characters that you kind of almost want to hang out with, even though they might be murderers or whatever. They're just like,
right.
You know, the guys that I knew that were like, hey, they're criminals, but hey, they're pretty entertaining criminals. You know, that's who they are. So that's you found in very much in the wrestling world is, although there is some, one of the weirdest, you know, they have a thing called Gaga. So in the days of wrestling, there were the big matches. And then because these things lasted 3 hours or so, there'd be like more spectacle type matches, the little mini matches, some of the crazy women matches of things. And so that still goes on in the WWE. And I think one of the weirdest times I ever had was pretty early on. And I got a call in my office from my boss at that time, Stephanie McMahon's husband, Triple H, Paul Levesque. And he's like, hey, I'm out of the office, but Vince wants to go over the ring gear for this new wrestler that's coming. Would you go up and take some notes and we can talk about those? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So I go up to this office conference room, and Vince is in there, and he's in there with this wrestler who's you know, about 3 foot high, and he's in a bull costume. And so, because he's going to be El Torito, and he's a Mexican high flyer wrestler, but he's not a midget or a little person. He's a perfectly formed human being and an unbelievable gymnastic athlete as well. So there's Vince all business, and I'm having my clipboard taking notes, and they'd be like, what about the tail? Is the tail too long? And I look, and then there's the bull's tail. I'm like, I don't know. It doesn't seem too long to me. He goes, oh, okay. He goes, what about is that the right color? Should the hoofs be a little of the color? And I go, yeah, I think they should be a little darker. And then then I look, and I'm like the little body in this guy. And I'm like, well, he's got, I thought he had a body stocking on, you know, And I was like, well, you know what? I don't know if the body stockings should have nipples in them. And then the little guy goes and goes, no, no, the nipples are mine. I'm like, oh, oh, it's your skin. It's like you have perfect skin. And I'm like, oh. And Vince is like, ha, 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 laugh, ha, ha. I thought they were his, that was his own nipples. And so it was like this bizarre, like wrestling experience, you know, and I think back to when I was a kid, like, okay, if some, like, you're going to be in a, here's your future. You're going to be with Vince McMahon going over a bull costume with a little guy from Mexico.
That's a great, like, I'll carry that one forward. No, no, the nipples are mine.
Yeah. And solid apparently line. This guy, El Torito, has three brothers that are his same size, and it's a family of, you know, came out of a circus, and then there were wrestlers in Mexico. And one night, they were all visiting him. So we're in this arena, in one of the rooms where the writers are, and all these hallways, you know. And so as I'm sitting there doing stuff, every 3 minutes, these four little mini guys would walk by, and then like 5 minutes later, they walk by, and I'm like, this never gets old. Four little mini guys keep going back and forth. It's like, oh, this is comedy gold. Yeah. So that's another moment.
So did you enjoy those jobs as much? Because it wasn't, you know, it was comedy restricted. I mean, it's more creativity and storytelling. But did you, you know, that, like, for me, I know when I've done jobs outside of comedy, like working in business, doing marketing for the last 5 years, it's like they get to hear about 3% of my thoughts, you know, because they can't handle more than that. Did you feel restricted?
Oh, right. No, because you know what? We'd have these production meetings and I could be funny in the meetings. I got a name, Fast Eddie, because I was quick with jokes. So they liked that. In fact, this one guy who also came from wrestling and was my head writer on the show I did with Orlando Jones gave me all the advice. She goes, Vince ever gets mad, just make him laugh. And I'm like, oh, and I did that different times and to get out of some trouble because Vince would get mad a lot for whatever reason. Maybe it was the steroids eventually that he gave up, but whatever. So, but creatively, and also the other thing is the wrestlers are such smart, creative people that they were fun to be around. You know, so many of them came, you know, as you look at like The Rock or John Cena or those other ones, they're really talented, not just in the physicality of it, but they're getting a full page of dialogue they have to memorize in a short amount of time. They have to deliver it to thousands and thousands of people. They have these characters. So when they go off into into the world of acting, they nail it because they've been doing it for 15 years. Dave Bautista, you know, going the Marvel stuff. So when you're around them, yeah, they're great guys. They're funny. It's like being around comedians, although they don't go up and tell jokes, but they have the same weird sense of humor. They've been on the road like comedians for years. They had tons of stories. So yeah, most of them are fun to be around and to kind of create because they can pull it off. Like, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about and I really miss about working, you know, in Hollywood, like being out in Austin and the hinterlands. You see raw talent all the time, you know, people who are funny, but it's not developed. You know, you can't just hand them something and watch them look at it for a few minutes and then go up and just crush it, you know, the way you see like a real pro. It's so I miss that kind of feeling, you know, of working with talent like that.
Yeah. And that's what that's who those guys are. And you know, that's what they're developed to be. And, you know, that's why so many of them have moved on past just, you know, the WWE and have done other things and continue to do that because it's, you know, their goals aren't, but again, that's what drives them. That's what they've really worked hard to be. And then, you know, like any, you know, that's happened with a lot of like regular athletes. It's like, oh, hey, I started here, but I moved over here. I became a broadcaster. I've done this, but it is a very, you know, closed sort of world and society, I guess. Because of the travel, just because it's 365 days a year, it's constant. It's not like there's a season. It's always wrestling, you know, 5 or 6 days a week.
Always. It sounds like a hard job. Was that a hard job?
Well, for me, yeah, I mean, I guess it was, I enjoyed it. It was 24/7. The writers, are incredibly, you know, they're traveling all the time. You're never in one spot. Now it's different because of what's COVID, but like, okay, on Monday for Raw, you're going to be in Orlando. Okay. So you get done with Raw at about 1 a.m. You get in a car or on a bus because you got a 4-hour ride or 6-hour ride to Miami. You get in Miami at 4 o'clock in the morning. You're, you know, in a hotel room, but then you have your meeting. You have to be up and at 1, you know, you're starting all over. And then on every month, there was a pay-per-view. So you took that and then you started like Sunday, you're in one place. Monday, you're in a 4 hours away. Tuesday, you're 5 or 6 hours away. You fly back on Wednesday morning to Stanford. You're setting up the shows then, when you're in the offices, you get Saturday off, part of Friday, if you're on the road sort of group. And then, yeah, and it's not like, well, we did it for 6 months, we take a break. It's like, no, it's just, wow. Keep going.
Yeah, so, think about that, like with, so was it like being on the floor at a sitcom where you need, there's a certain amount of improvising work or day of work, like on a talk show, or is it all pre-written and you're just...
No, well how it works, how that kind of works writer-wise is, so the writers are coming up with all this, they're meeting with Vince during the week, but ultimately the arbiter of everything is Vince McMahon. So you can plan everything, but then suddenly whatever Vince talked to some of the other wrestlers, they got their ideas. So a lot of it's put together, you might be 1 hour into Raw and you're still writing the show.
Uh-huh.
So you're like, and it's live. So it's like, we got to keep writing it. You keep working on it. And then the material's coming out to the wrestler. It's like, okay, you got 10 minutes, you got to learn this, you're out. And also it's not just dialogue. It's all these moves. It's like how you have to orchestrate it, like it is a Marvel sort of movie with physicality and who pins what, and it's got to look great and it's shot. So behind the scenes of it is Vince and the, one of the experienced wrestlers who's retired, who's producing all this in an area they call Gorilla. Gorilla's behind the scenes of everything. And so, they're talking to the truck with the director who's shooting everything. They have a writer there who's making sure that the dialogue is right. Because if you make a mistake, you're setting up things for the next several weeks. So they're in the referee's ear. They're it's all being produced and all produced really live. So it's a pretty amazing live spectacle. And I did, that was the other thing, I had done live TV, but not in that level to where there's so many people involved. So it's everything comes together at that, it's like putting on a play every Monday and then doing it again Tuesday.
That's
it's
crazy.
It's insane.
that is insane. Like, so those aren't union jobs, right? There's no, is there a,
well, it's a corporation. It's publicly. Yeah. So you're, the difference between that is, you have benefits and you have a pension and you have all, and there's HR and it's a year round job, too. So, and you get stock, you can buy stock. And so it's different than if it's a sitcom where it's like, hey, we're in production 8 months out of the year. Then we go away. It's like, no, it's like a GE. Like, oh, I work for GE. Well, no, you work for WWE,
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. All that, the amount of manpower and, effort that takes must have been enormous.
Well, yeah. And that was, so part of that was, that part of my job. The other part as head of creative was, there's a lot of other entities besides just those shows. So at that time they had a magazine. There was, I was kind of the liaison between them and consumer products. So there's all these toys being pumped out, action figures, the new wrestlers, there was 80 of them in Orlando that were being developed. in their own called NXT. So I would have to go down there, meet with Mattel. Mattel would come, measure the wrestlers, give you notes on what the ring gear was, because eventually they'd be making their action figure, you know, and so that's a whole nother entity that would put on their own show. And then eventually those people would move in to the WWE, but they're developed there. They learn how to wrestle and not get hurt. So there's, you know, that part of it. There's publishing. There's a studio which was doing movies. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
So yeah, I learned a lot. You know, I wasn't as on the guy before me, which was nobody. But then we had somebody a year before. You know, spent most of his time in wrestling. And then when I got there, I'm like, you guys have that covered. I'll go there. You know, I was going like once or twice a month. But most of my role, I felt was more in the what I knew, the TV and promotional portion of it, because that's what they needed. They didn't have that before. So I kind of focused on that, which was, you know, fun. So I would come back to LA once a month to interview writers. So I was traveling around and a lot of it's corporate jets. So it's pretty easy, you know, so be like, okay, I'm done. I get on the corporate jet and I fly back that night, get up, do this stuff. So it was definitely an interesting year and a half or whatever it was.
So it sounds, you said that, you felt like you did some things to alter their business model some. So like, what do you mean by that?
I guess you know, it's funny because one of the things that one of the other parts of my job was to work, kind of be a liaison with their digital side and the head of digital. And so they're very progressive and when I was there, they were developing their over the top network that got launched and actually just got morphed into Peacock Network. And they had their first, like the WWE app. And so the app was eventually used to get subscribers, but they wanted to, you know, so part of my job was also monetizing things and learning how to use the app. And so I really brought in, I was just talking about this today, a digital writer to work in between the digital side and the creative side so that they knew what they were doing. And because I, you know, all my life was like, hey, looking by minute, by minutes and things, you could really start to see like, hey, there's certain patterns here. And nobody was paying attention. Like the female wrestlers, the divas that we call them, which were like, again, the gagas, like, oh, we threw up the female wrestlers. I'm like, well, I look at the ratings and actually every female wrestling match equals the highest rating that you've got for that for Raw. So it's that, you know, you're less, you should actually have two of those matches. Right. So I used to position them to where after at the end of an hour where they would have their main, the crossover, you know, that's when people are like, okay, it's over. It's like, but if you put a Divas match after it, people actually stayed through the commercial. So by, you know, using TV science and and having this data, it's like, sure. You know, I put in the extra Divas match and they started doing more of that. And then at the same time, they were doing Total Divas on E. They were like, oh, you know, it's some show with the women. I'm like, well, actually, if you look at the cum of that ratings, that's outdrawing really what you're getting at Raw, your main show. So it's like, you have to focus on these outside things that because your guy wrestlers are not paying attention to. And then the same thing of using everyone's Twitter feed and to promote matches.
Right,
we kind of created this universe, the WWE universe, which like everybody at one time go, you got to tune in. Dusty Rhodes could lose his job because his sons win and like, what? Ah, we got to watch, tune in. And you could see like, oh, there are rating spikes because all these social media followers, when they're pinpointed, would push towards the creative. So things like that, which are fun because you're like, hey, you know what? You can figure it out. Look, there's a pattern. And I would sell it to Vince. So it happened for a full month. Oh, okay. You know, they like that.
You know, I always wanted to do that with stand-ups. Like I always felt there was enough synergy like in the stand-up community between, you know, that for if people really knew the breadth of and the, you know, the texture of like all the stand-ups out there, that it was a community, and the nerds that tend to like, you know, to deep dive on like Patton Oswalt or whatever.
Right.
Nobody's ever really farmed, you know, stand-up outside of its, you know, kind of stage presence. And with that, you know, like you get an hour and 20 minutes of it's great and, you know, whatever. But everybody judges just that final product. They don't do all the side stuff like you're talking about where you're, you know, harvesting more from what, because they're crazy. You know, like we were talking about Brian Regan before we started.
Yeah.
And you know, just talking to Brian, you can listen to him tell his ordinary stories about his life or what happened that day. And it's really funny. You know, it's not something you take on stage, but it's not harvested the same way that some of these things are.
Well, you'll have to watch my new show with Adam Sandler's company called Comic Genius, where? That's what we'll do. Yeah. Gets on the air, which are in the development stages now, but that I'm taking my WWE experience and that universe and bringing it over to a comedy competition to that exact same thing. It's like there's performances, but also I know, and you know, from hanging out with comedians, it's like, hey, they're funny over here. You know, they're funny on Twitter. It's like, it's the same thing as how do you take those along with you, make this a 24/7 experience that then leads to a funny performance and that on a TV show. But at the same time, people love to like, oh, you know, hey, I had a horrible set. Let me tell you about that. It's like, yeah, okay. I want to know about that because that you made that really funny. Yeah, I liked your bit about, oh, what I did with, you know, kids, that. But this part of it showed me something that I didn't see before. So yeah, I'm using that in that world of developing this, you know, this show and using what I learned there, the WWE, to kind of say, hey, it's the same thing.
As soon as you were talking about, you know,
it's
wrestlers.
Full circle.
As soon as you're talking about wrestlers, you know, and how fun they are to hang out with and, you know, the texture of all that stuff. I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally like with stand-ups, you know, when you, hang out with them, you're like, oh, there's a lot here. You know, there's a lot of.
Well, yeah,
you've never seen.
There's this one famous wrestler I work with, this guy, called Road Dogg. And he's been around for years and part of this, you know, these outlaw guys. And so one time I would ride with he and another guy from the company, you know, like these 4-hour drives. And the first time I rode with them, you know, Road Dogg, who's crazy and stuff, all they did was sing Michael Bublé songs the whole way. Like, I go, this is not what your fans expect, that you're, you know, your crooner belting out Michael Bublé songs along the Tamiami Trail.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it.
But they did.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember when Last Comic Standing, there were a couple of seasons where they tried to expand what it was, where they would do, like, they were in the house, you know, and they put them into, you know, uncomfortable situations where they had to do like improv for kids and things like that. And I'm like, you don't really understand stand up. You know, when you're doing that to people, like, I'm going to put you in a situation that you can't handle and no preparation, no writers, no help. And, you know, you'll just overcome it. And I'm like, no, they won't. You know, that's not going to work.
No, right. And it's more of the, here, let me tell you about the bad experience that I had that I made funny. Then in the moment, people think, oh, when people aren't funny, it's funny. It's like, no, it's still not funny.
Yeah, still not funny.
Tell you about the horrible thing. Like, I worked with this guy once, I forget who it was, but I'm like, hey, what have you been doing? He goes, oh, I just did my first college. And I'm like, oh, that's good. How was that? He goes, yeah, it was just weird. I go, what? He goes, I had to MC this thing. I go, what was it? He goes, well, I got there and they just said it was like a student performance. And then I would go up and do time in between each one. I'm like, yeah. I go, so what was weird? I go, were they comedians? He goes, no. He goes, it was a grieving class. And so people got up and told about loved ones that just died. And then I was supposed to come back and go, hey, okay, let me lighten it up the room. Next guy, like, and then the cancer and my mother, and, you know, I was 12 and it's like, okay, hey, it was great. I'm like, yeah. I go, that's funnier, you know, not telling it now than being there and trying to bring people back from tears every time.
Nobody, surely other professions aren't exactly like this, right? Where everybody has weird experiences at their job, but not like stand up or wrestling or whatever, where it's just like you tell people and they're like, what? You know?
Yeah, no, yeah. No, I'm sure you've had it too. Stand up. I mean, there's performances where you're like, wait, what was I hired to do? You know, yeah. Like, yeah, we thought it'd be great to do this. It's like, well, it's like, huh?
Yeah, I got hired to do.
I mean, I've done it. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that one of the weirdest gigs I did was I got hired to do stand up at the wedding reception for a Indian couple, a young Indian couple from, and we did it at Churchill Downs in one of the sky boxes at Churchill Downs. And their parents were like, everybody in the room was like doctors. So it was a really high end wedding. And half the people had come over from India and the other half were Americanized. And so she hired me. She saw me do stand up. And she's like, will you come to my, you know, to my reception, do comedy? I'm like, it's going to be horrible. And she's like, I know, that's what I want to see. Because I want to see my relatives from India, you know, in excruciating pain because they don't get any of your material.
Yeah, it's like, all right, you're paying, I guess.
And then every 15 minutes, they'd run another race. So I'd be in the middle of a bit and the announcer would come on and they're at the post. And everybody would wander outside. And I'm like, oh, here we are.
Yeah, yeah, no. There's the idea of what people think it will be good or that what they want. Yeah, I think we've all, you know, had those sort of experiences to where it's like, hey, you know what? That just sucked, but I got paid.
Yeah,
but, comedian just told me that
that's it, right? She paid me like a crazy amount of money to do that.
Yeah, no, I mean the most money I ever made once in stand up early on was to do a human pyramid contest at a college. They had seen me at NAPTI, you know, that conference where people, you know, and hired, and they flew me to like Missouri, and I got there and I'm like, well, what am I doing? I'm emceeing what? And they're like, oh, it's a human pyramid contest. So I go, so what do I do? He goes, yeah, we want you to do some time. And then you'll basically say, Dive Felt the Kai. And then they all pyramid. And then they're like, okay, then set it five. And then the next one's to do it. So I'm like, yeah, okay. And this was a really polite college, or well, you know, and then so they were a little rowdy. I did like 15 minutes. I started to introduce a few, and then I was supposed to do a half hour. And they were like, hey, the crowd's really rowdy. So just do the pyramid stuff. I'm like, what? They go, yeah, okay. I'm done in 45 minutes. It was like, you know, like $5,000 flew me in. I'm like, okay. This pays for all those horrible things.
Yeah, that's the final tally is always, I got paid what? I don't care.
Yeah, for that.
I don't care what I did. I got paid this. Yeah. Okay, we're out. Right. So the wrestling thing, just put a cap on it. Like is that a career that people like, I'm sure like creatively, do people go in there and just stay in that? Or is it like a revolving door to get to other things?
I would say like on the writing staff, there's a few people who are there for kind of the long haul, because once you're in and you're moving up and you get paid well and you're getting benefits and you know, it's a harder move to go from that to non-wrestling.
Right.
Because you've been in it for a while. The wrestling's like the writer's assistant. There's people that come in for a couple of years. Okay, I got that experience, and then go back like the writers that I've worked with are working on dramas and comedies and other things. And they kind of like, hey, you know what? I kind of started out writing for TV. I wanted to go back there. I tried it. I enjoyed it. But again, it's not an easy life, you know, although you can make a good living and it's not going to go away. So you can, you know, that's the trap of it, you know? So there's some people that have been there for quite some time. The kind of the wild card is Vince, because he gets bored with people and suddenly it's like, I don't know. They don't know what they're doing. And it's like, well, it's, you know, that type of thing. So you're always you never know when the firing squad's, you know, coming to get you.
Yeah. For mercurial personalities. I mean, you've got plenty of experience at that. So.
Yeah. 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 And I got cut off in layoffs because they had, when they launched this over the top network, they spent too much. They laid off 10% of the company. It was like, well, it's not for call. You know, we love what you're doing. And I'm like, no, I get it. You know, they pay you severance. You're like, okay. And then my thing was like, okay, how am I, can I use this in a different way? Use the experience. And I still have contacts there and still have friends. And I had done some other writing for them and was working on a feature project, digital project for them and things. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, anytime overall, you wander.
It was a good experience. Yeah. And it was one of those things where like, hey, I'm taking things away from it that I'll use in other projects.
Well, that's awesome, man. I remember way back when asking somebody, what's Eddie up to these days? And somebody said that he's writing for World Wrestling. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
There's a veer from hardcore political, arcane, you know, upper, you know, intellectual Dennis Miller on HBO stuff over to wrestling. I said, man, he bounces.
I like to see it. And then I sandwiched it with Law and Order thrown in there. That's a nice bit of roast beef in the middle of that sandwich.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks, man. This is super fun.
Yeah.
You know,
I enjoy it.
Yeah. I love this stuff. Maybe it's just me, but I love, you know, getting into the nuts and bolts of these things and, you know, the kind of these jobs. And I try to drag it back over into, you know, the stuff I'm trying to offer to people for, you know, constructing, you know, political talk and persuasion and things like that. But I could just sit here and, you know, just listen to
them. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what, we talked about it before, but you know, that persuasiveness, that really hitting the gut of the average wrestling fan is hitting the gut of the average voter. And it's out, you know, it's stump speeches, really. You're out selling yourself and your product, you know, out and around the country. So, you know, there's, you know, you're persuading people to suddenly like you and root for you. And that's what politics is.
Yeah, it's all the same thing. It's constructing, you know, effective messaging that works with, you know, Americans across, you know, many different regions and, you know, orientations. And, you know, I think the Democrats are going to have to, like I said, you know, harvest much more from this, the storytelling and the entertainment, you know, because that's what everybody's grown up on now. They're not growing up on, you know, wonky politics. Nobody's reading the, you know, long articles in the, you know, Washington Times about, you know, the issues. They're grabbing stuff real quickly off the internet and you have to adjust.
Yeah. I mean, the days of Tim Russert are over. It's great. That sort of thing where you came on and, you know, it's like, okay, I got some, you have some access and you get to hear. It's like, that's not what people are used to or want to hear, you know?
Well, even the intellectual tradition of the right that I've seen, like the George, you know, Wills and, you know, those guys, you know, which was, I never bought into a conservative approach to the world because I'm a comedian and I want, you know, I want a fun America. I don't want a, you know, a stilted, you know, scared America or like, you know, don't give the children too much rein. But at least it was an intellectual tradition and it was a hardcore one, you know, but that's gone away.
Yeah, that's not there. No, I mean, these days when I look at it, like I have a feeling, you know, these days Caligula would be really a conservative Christian. You know, that's how he would like, I have all these orgies, but really I'm a conservative Christian. And they're like, oh, he's a conservative Christian. It's like, it's good. Caligula. Yeah. What about all this? Like, oh, come on. That's the world where you can go, you know, if you look now where it's gone politically on the right, it's like, you know, it's like, I became handicapped when I was at the Naval Academy. It's like, he was never at the Naval Academy. That's not true. They're like, I was an Army Ranger. It's like, he wasn't an Army Ranger.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, well, nobody checks or they don't care. So,
well, nobody checks your wrestlers, right? Your wrestlers make these massive fictional claims and it creates this, you know, engaging, heightened character. But nobody goes in and checks, you know, where, like, how many steroids is The Rock on? You know, nobody checks these things. It's just, I like to see this blown up muscle character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like this, it's entertainment. You know, it is, it's all entertainment. And that really, that's what Trump was. It's just entertainment. There was nothing, whenever I talk to a Trump fan, there's never like, well, I like the pop, these pop. And then what he did is like, well, he did nothing. He did less than nothing. He should have done something. He did nothing. You dislike the personality behind it.
Right.
Which is for TV, fine. But somehow it's like, hey, there's 400,000 dead because you know what? It didn't fit his image to say, hey, we got to do something about it. It's like, oh, in my sitcom, I wouldn't do that. It's like, right. Well, yeah, but it's not a sitcom. And, you know, it's like, it's real. And all these people are dead. But yet people are going, yeah, well, he fought for us. It's like, no.
Yeah, but, I don't know, man. No. The tsunami of entertainment coming into politics, because politics is storytelling that affects somebody's life. Like wrestling, you see storytelling. Every once in a while, you see some kid go home and, you know, throw his brother over a, you know, the clothesline or something, you know, but it's not affecting the whole nation. Like you don't write a storyline at wrestling and then the next day the whole, you know, somebody loses all their, you know, benefits because of your story.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because you're telling people now, nobody wear a mask. I wear a mask, even though you're like, what? Yeah,
so it's a weird overlap of, you know, the stuff we do about just pure fiction and story and things like that. But when it breaks over into real life like that, it opens up all these issues, these ethical issues. And, you know, like, what should the limits of entertainment be? There's no way to limit it anymore. Like I say, it's a tsunami. It's coming in. It's broken into politics and it's not going away. So we have to come up with new ways of dealing with it. But it's going to get better and better, right? I mean, as the writers and the production structures get imported over, it's going to get better.
Yeah. Well, I do think that maybe, you know, they're bringing it up that, you know, that they did away with the fairness doctrine, because, you know, at some point it's like, hey, yeah, your ratings are good. You're making money, but you're lying to people and people are dying. I mean, I liken it to, like, if the HGTV decided that from now on, 11 inches is a foot, you know, that's a foot is 11 inches. And then people are building things. It's like, why are things crooked? I'm like, I don't know. I did exactly like HGTV said that. And it's like, well, yeah, but now, you know, things are exploding where people are dying. It's like, well, you lied. It's not 11 inches, aren't a foot. You know, that's where we are, where people are saying things and not true, except the difference is there are people, you know, suffering and dying from it.
Well, and that's why I split this stuff into ethical only persuasion and unethical persuasion, because it has nothing to do with right or left or anything like that. It's like if somebody is using unethical persuasion, like lying, they should be taken out of the equation. Like if you listen to that, it's going to ruin all the public discourse because you can't rely on information anymore. And it's going to, you know, pull a certain number of people over into misinformation. The problem is the form of persuasion itself. It's unethical persuasion is dangerous to a democracy.
Yeah.
You know, and getting people to recognize that, you know, and say, hey, if somebody lies on their resume, it's not, oh, you know, let it go. It's they are banned from politics forever.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah.
You know,
well, it's fun. I did a little experiment the other day on Facebook just to see, which was I'm like, hey, at least we can all agree on this, and printed five facts. Basically facts that you know, and you know what? Normally I would get like a couple of the Trump fans like, oh, this and that. I didn't give an opinion on anything. I just said, hey, this is a fact. You know, there was no widespread voter thing. The virus didn't go away, blah, blah, blah. And I found like, oh, nobody came at me because I didn't give an opinion. All I did was to list facts. If I, you know, said something about Trump opinion wise, then they're going to come back as an opinion.
Right.
But the facts, they can't go, I want to go at him, but there's no place. How do I get in at him? But I know, because I would have to then, you know, show that, you know, he could come at me. So I was just like, oh, I got plenty of people agreeing and likes and things and that, but no, none of my little Trump fans came in to attack.
Yeah. And that is literally ethical persuasion. You've just told the truth in a bare format. You know, that's why journalism, you know, started at least in its foundations to rely on that. Like we try to get as objective as possible. We try to just report the facts of what happened because that's an ethical stance. You know, journalism got hit by the same forces of entertainment to pull it over into let's make these facts a little more interesting by adding in the idiots, you know, who don't even agree with this to give it more flavor because you need good and evil. But journalism gets boring really quickly because it's basically just, you know, good. It's just good and facts. So it's not story wars like that.
Right. Yeah. No. And that's really what the cable companies have become. Fox is like, You know, my difference is, I would say, being liberal somewhat, is that, you know, MSNBC is a very opinion oriented, but they take a fact and they give you your opinions on it. Fox takes a fact, changes the fact, then gives you opinion on what they changed. You know, it's like, again, their opinions would be based on a foot is 11 inches.
Right.
You know, and it's like, wait, we passed over that. So as you know, Danny, with a foot being 11 inches, you know, that's why I only need this much material. And we're like, well, okay, wait a minute. Can we go back to the foot is 11 inches? Let's go on. You're obscuring the point here. I'm talking about the right. House. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes a lot more sophisticated, you know, ability to parse it out so that you can say, look, it's okay to give opinions. Like, it's okay for Fox to give opinions. I don't care if they give, you know, opinions, but you can't let them infiltrate the facts. Like, if you just say, here are the facts. Now we there's no voter fraud. There was no voter fraud in this election. But we still, you know, want there to be, or we still would prefer it to be, or, you know, like maybe they could have done these things, but we know where they didn't, but
yeah,
then they'd be okay. But that's a more sophisticated way of talking and holding them, you know, their feet to the fire, their tongues to the fire, that we just don't have really. Like, journalism can't do that to it. Can't force them to talk like that. The fairness doctrine right. had some of those teeth, but
yeah,
like you said, it got pulled away and there's nothing now controlling them other than like this Dominion lawsuit, you know?
Well, that's it. Right. I mean, that's the only thing that's controlling them is capitalism and somebody saying, no, guess what? I'm going to sue you because you're lying and you're hurting my business. Then immediately, like, oh, what? Oh, no, we, oh, we're, yeah, huh?
Yeah, I don't but know. No, we didn't mean nobody. That.
Like, I mean, Tucker Carlson, basically his lawyers won a case by saying, well, it's just entertainment. No one believes it. You know, what happened, tying it back to wrestling, at one time, you know, Vince, because it was like boxing, he had to get, permits. And they were kind of stifling his business. So finally, he really said, okay, I'm changing my business. Yeah, letting you know, it's sports entertainment. There's a predetermined outcome. You know, it's not real. I'm telling you that. So, you know, yeah, we're going to make you think it's real and all that sort of stuff, but it's not. And that, because of that, he was able to, you know, don't need like boxing commission permits and that. Really, that's what, you know, Tucker Carlson's is like, hey, we're telling you it's not real. But that message is obscured and nobody goes, oh, well, hey, it's entertainment. None of it's real. They're like, it is real. It's like, yeah, because you're too stupid
right.
or whatever, or don't care to see that they're telling you it's not.
Well, it's got to become like the warnings on cigarette packages. It can't ever go away. They make that statement one time. He doesn't start his show with, hey, nothing I'm going to tell you tonight is true.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's this message way over there that, you know, 70% of them never even heard,
yeah.
You know, right. And it's like, you know, if you're going to do this stuff, and then again, it's sort of the project of the Rhetoric Warriors is getting more sophisticated ways of doing even, you know, our modern communication, because it's all morphed. It's all become this production oriented, high dollar, high talent. And you've got to do other things to contain it because people can't handle it. I mean, it's literally overwhelming everybody and they're believing crazy shit because it's so well produced.
Yeah. Yeah. No. The people are good. I mean, that's what, you know, I said before, like when I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh, when I was driving out to do all my colleges, you know, I realized like, okay, I see, you know, I can only listen so much, but I realized like, I see what he's doing. You know, it's a very dictatorship. It's like everything I say, and then when I have somebody on, they're very weak, and I smash them, and then they are like, ha ha, look at that. It's like, well, I'm just saying we have to be good to each other. Oh, good to each other. Well, I suppose. And they're like, I guess. And then, you know, that's what Fox is. Fox is. That's why you'll never see any of those. You know, their people on any other shows. They can't. You know, if you're going to see Hannity come over to another network. He could. That's not a contractual thing. Is because then people go, you know, Sean, but this isn't true. And then he's like, well, anyway, it's like, no, here, look, it's not true. It's like, no, I can't have that. I can't come out into the real world.
Yeah, it's weird. Out. Like CNN having Rick Santorum on, you know, like CNN got, you know, all this pressure for years and years, you know, about avoiding the right. And they finally have a guy on like that. And he's so out of place and it's so heinous. I can't watch it. I have to turn it off if he's going to say things, because it doesn't fit the aesthetic. It doesn't fit even the tiny amount of attachment they've been able to hold on to with journalism, you know. It doesn't fit even that. And it's like, why would you let this guy in? It's like you would be having a wrestling and you would have a ballerina, you know, suddenly walk into the, you know, or a distance, long distance runner to fight. And you'd be like, what's this?
That Well, but again, that's, you know, they have him because it's a produced, you know, it's that, I mean, Scott Carter did a long time ago with like Politically Incorrect, where it's like, hey, we're going to invite the weak Republican. You know, your job, I'm producing this segment and your job is to be the other side of it. And then we'll take you apart. I mean, Santorum agrees to it because he gets paid. But there's a producer, as we know, in his ear saying, no, your job is to be the asshole. That's why we hire you.
But
if
they
you don't
want
to be the asshole.
Like, he doesn't lose in a satisfying way. Like, you know, but I think like that's watching all kind wrestling of the, and then your guys always.
Oh, no, that's right. Lose, yeah. You know? Yeah, but again, it's a pretty, you know, it's that, it's like they have him for a reason and he's getting paid. And if they did, if, you know, they didn't have to have him, they could not have him, but something says, yeah, we need to have that guy because ratings wise, you know, that's why it's like, hey, just turn him off. If you see him, turn him off, because they had minute by minute ratings.
Yeah, I mute him. You know, I do. Yeah. If I'm watching something, I'll mute him. But it's like, you know, it is interesting to watch them try to again figure that out. Like, can you add in a villain to the sort of heroic, you know, side and still maintain the aesthetic? And to me, like in journalism and stuff like that, you really can't. You can add you can add in other people, but adding like a total villain into that setting, it just, you know, it's too much of a shift to me.
And yeah, like, no, you
want
yeah.
him, I'll go get him, you know, but I don't want him over here.
Right. Well, it's like when they go, okay, like everyone, that segment every once in a while, let's go see what the Trump voters have to say. It's like, why? Okay. I'm not watching that either. I get it. I know that's your go-to thing. Yeah. Okay. You know,
yeah. I didn't listen to Trump for at least 3.5 years. Like, I would turn it off all the time. I would never listen.
Yeah. I never would. Yeah.
You know, if I did, I would control it. Like, I would come in afterwards and I would do like little clips and find something to kind of laugh at or whatever, but letting him kind of dominate the story space, like come in and, you know, where I couldn't protect my brain from him. That was horrible. That was an awful idea for America.
Yeah. No. And you would still see, and there are people I know too, that were like Democrats, liberals, like they're watching on Fox. It's like, why are you watching him? It's like, I want to see what he says. It's like, well, yeah, then you count. And they're like, hey, you know, it's not like it's not connected. That Fox goes to Trump and goes, hey, our ratings are great. Keep it up. And it's like, well, how come he keeps saying it? Because you keep watching.
Yeah, because you keep watching.
It's not like out there in the world of like, how, you know, it's like they know you're watching. And so they're going to keep doing that.
Well, and look at the amount of villainy it took for them to cancel him, like the real world villainy. Like it had to be so big. You know, an insurrection at the Capitol with, you know, some death in it. And, you know, and they keep trying to intensify it with kidnappings and they were going to hang Pence and all this because they had to make it so big that the villainy, you know, was so real that they could finally cancel him.
You know, yeah, I know. And even then, I mean, I always had my control group of Trump supporters on Facebook. There's someone I went to, I won't say her name, but someone I went to grade school with. And it's like one of those things you're like, today she's posted something with Nancy Pelosi, like she has to go. It's like, okay. Well, again, I don't reply anymore, but like, and how would you make that happen? Okay, she has to go. And then are you going to move to San Francisco to her district where it's, you know,
right.
30 times what you're paying for your house. You're going to do that. And okay, now you're there. Now what? It's just to get out of that.
Are you going to go through the democratic process to get the effect you want?
Yeah. How would that work?
You're just going to scream and threaten. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's perfectly fine. Like, you know, the Democrats could have literally just said, hey, we're winning California by 10 million. Spread those people out into the South. you know, have them all move to Ohio and Florida, and they could take those states. But nobody wants to make that sacrifice for their politics.
Yeah. And so she's not, believe me, she's not. But again, she's someone who posts, you know, she's a mom and now a grandmother, posts like her daughter, because her father was like a fireman, and now her daughter's becoming a fire person. And it's like, well, you know, of the people out there, Nancy Pelosi probably has more to do with making that happen than your Republican friends. But you don't know that. You don't think of that. All you just say is like getting rid of your hero, Donald Trump.
Well, and the cool thing is that when you get professionals like you and, you know, guys who really understand, people who really understand story and all these elements, that you can import them all over to the Democratic side too. You know, you can tell better stories than what Trump told. Yeah. Trump wasn't particularly great. He was a good, you know, villain, anti-hero, but he just did reality show clumsiness. You know, and Biden is interesting, you know, I think for some reason as a hero figure, but, you know, just build a better story, you know, for the left, and they could pull those people back. They just want a good story.
Yeah. Just tell me, you know, in a clever way what it is and, you know, yeah, engage me. And also, I think they're looking at, and Biden did it a little bit at this press conference to this Fox reporter who asked them, you know, when you talk to Putin, it's like, what do you talk about? You. He asked how you were. It's like, yeah, give it, you know, give it back to him. And that's why, you know, it's like, yeah, we're not taking your bullshit, you know, anymore, you know, and, you know, it's like, what? Oh, hey, you can't, you know.
Right.
You can't say that.
Yeah, you can't, like, if you're bad to the bad people, you are bad. I'm like, no. Yeah. This is what we do to the bad people. Yeah. The bad people like, get slapped around because they're bad people.
Right. And now what you're finding, I'm seeing, is that because Trump was so out there that there's no arguments anymore. It's like you can win. The arguments are so easy to win because, like, well, we shouldn't do that, but you just did that. Oh, well, you shouldn't do that, but you guys just did that and you were okay with it. Oh.
I made this point, like, that, you know, the insurrection, everything pushed. Trump screwed up because everything else before was imaginary. It was phone calls. It was things we heard. We didn't get to see it. This was a produced all day long, hyper visual, and there's no getting past it. You know, it'll fade over time, but it's so strong as a symbol that you can always just go, yeah, oh, well, what about that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Look at that. Yeah. To me, it was actually, I think about the perfect representation of the Trump presidency, because it was all anger. We're going to get in there. Now we're in there. It's like, what do we do? Let's take some pictures. I don't know. This is a building. How are you going to govern it? Well, I don't know. I got my antler hat. Where my antler? Well, back to
it went from, you know, Trump's fiction world where he's always building, you know, fictional good and evils, and it became real. And then people got to see it for what it really was. And they're like, these guys are idiots.
Yeah, that's you. Yeah. If you can look at your hardworking uncle and go, huh, see that moron? That's what you look like. Okay. What? It's like, yeah, the guy in the you know, in the tunic who's out there, it's like those guys, that's you. That's what you know. It's like I said it before. It's like, remember, like when you do at a club and they're like, oh, hey, the guy, the MC is going to be the guy from the morning zoo coming in from the radio show. You're like, okay. And they were horrible. And not only were they horrible, but they brought their fans. And for the first time, they saw like, oh, my fans are morons. Like, yeah, that's what you bring. Morons. Yeah. That's what your zoo show is with your bad jokes and racist jokes. That's you. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's such a backstop to everything, so highly produced. It's just perfect. Like, Trump did not understand that he was, I think it's the kind of death knell of that sort of fascism intrusion, because you suddenly get to see it. And we didn't get to see all the, like, you know, death camps or murders or things like that, that you get with real fascism, but we got to see, you know, a play act of it, you know, in a real place. And that's the first time we've seen it. You know, it's the first time it's like, oh, look at it. That's what happens. Is chaos.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, because there's no, that's what you're mining. That's what you're constantly, those rallies, all those sort of things, that's where it's lead. It's not going to lead to a better place. There's no policy. There's no, everything is just destroy things. It's just, it sucked. That turned, I don't know what they're doing. Hey, I'm the best. What are you? It's like Jerky Boys.
Right.
Yeah, bringing
that's
your
exactly
shoes
right.
Glasses.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's Jerky Boys. And and people don't know, like, he went in and all those resources had not yet been, firebombed. Nobody had come in and done that. And he firebombed all of them. There's nothing left. Like, you see Cruz and Hawley and these guys trying to do Trumpian type things. And it's like, hey, idiot, that's already been done. Yeah. We're not interested anymore. You sound like a bad version of Trump.
Right. Yeah, that's what you're doing. And they can't, and you're not matching up. And, it took all kinds of things to get together and that to get him to where, somehow he popped his head out.
Yeah. Well, 40 years of fame within the culture, and then 10 years or 8 years or whatever it was as a top rated TV show, nobody else has that. You can't, Josh Hawley can't lead the sitcom.
No,
launch with Hawley.
It's like one of the writers, like, I could be a star of a show. It's like, well, no, you can't.
No, you can't. No, it doesn't work that way.
That's not your thing.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, again,
all right.
Clearly we can talk. So,
So anytime, happy to do it.
All right.
So good to see you.
I will circle back around. We are Rhetoric Warriors, helping the good people beat the bad people with better rhetoric. So come back and we'll see you next time.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.